Election day is only 2 weeks away, and chances are good that you've already got your ballot. Maybe you've even voted already. For some, this election season can't end soon enough. It feels like things are getting uglier by the day. Full disclosure, here at the show, we've struggled a bit with just how to cover this election season at a time when Arizona politics feel more divisive than ever, focused on personality instead of policy. So, in an effort to get to the heart of what matters to the people who live here, we're abandoning the candidates. Well, sort of. Instead, we're hearing from experts on how this election could impact everything from the economy to the environment. We're talking to young people about their views, and we're digging into why the disconnect between the elected and the electorate seems to grow wider all the time. We're calling this coverage the Great Divide. And today, we continue that coverage with a step back in time. Art Hamilton served in the Arizona legislature for more than a quarter of a century. He learned a lot about what it means to be in the minority, both as a Democrat and as an African American. And I sat down with him recently to talk more about his long political career in Arizona and how much politics has changed since he left and what's been lost in that shift. Here's our conversation.
I'm a fellow who grew up in the 1960s. I have no idea how you could grow up in that period and not be inclined toward politics. John Kennedy was elected and I believe sworn in 61. He was my political hero. Martin Luther King was just coming into his own. Civil rights was the issue of that decade and probably still is. And it just seemed to me that the obligation was to do something. Maybe you couldn't do the great things, the big things, but do what you can and do it where you happen to sit right now. I've always wanted to be around the legislature. I always wanted to be a member. And when the opportunity prevailed itself or availed itself to me, I said, take a crack at it, son. What do you got to lose?
And you were there for 26 years. Is that right?
I believe if you look in the encyclopedia, the picture of term limits will be mine. Yes, I was there for a very long time.
What made you stay?
Because I believe in the institution, because I enjoyed it. We had a chance to do many things. We did things I think that were important. When I first started, we didn't have a access health care program in the state. We brought Medicaid in during my period of time being there. We had 1,000 state agencies, but we turned those into state departments that gave us some idea that we could organize. We tried to make education a little less dependent on just local wealth, but the state had a burden to help educate our children no matter where they happened to be or how rich or poor the neighborhoods were. It just seemed to me there was a never-ending list of things to be tackled and done, and we could either light a candle or curse the darkness, and I was in the candle lighting business.
Did you feel like you faced a lot of racism in the legislature or things that would not fly today?
Well, I think, frankly, the legislature in many ways was a body probably closer to the last century than this, and yet I find that the amount of racial animus was probably less then than it is now. We have become a nation divided by a common history. We seem to see it so differently. And rather than being able to honor and discuss and try to reach some compromise on what we really wish to believe, we've gone to our separate corners. We stay there and we speak as if somehow this country has had two very distinct histories and not one. And that's really sad.
I want to talk more about that in a moment. But first, let's talk about what it was like when you were there. I mean, one of the things I think that is central to your legacy is bipartisanship. You were always in the minority in 26 years as the Democratic leader for most of them. So you had to work across the aisle. You had to work with people who disagreed with you on a lot of things to get anything done. Give us an example or two of like how you did that at the time and what it was like.
Well, I was able to do it not because I had any particular genius, but because the person who was the majority leader, Burton S. Barr, always felt that the better the minority was, the better the majority would be because they needed the challenge of being required to rise up in order to make legislation what it really ought to be. So Mr. Barr took it upon himself to train me, to train Alfredo Gutierrez, to help us become people who knew the process. And he was as good as his word. And he and I on occasion would fight like cats and dogs. He and I on occasion would see things very differently. But it never, ever became personal. And that's what's so, I think in many ways differentiates how the place is run today. Mm. We simply never let it become personal. I'm a child of the 60s, and I'm a John Kennedy kid. And John Kennedy, in his inaugural address, said that civility is never a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. And so I made it my business, to the degree that I was able, to remain civil, at times with very sharp elbows, mm-hmm. but making sure people understood that what I disagreed with them about were issues. I disagreed with them about philosophy. I disagreed with them about what I thought the government ought to do and ought not to do, but not about them and not about the fact that we might not see the world the same. It was, in fact, I think our differences, and I still think it is our differences, that are our strength if we treat them with respect, both mine and how I view the other person across the table. The thing that we have, I think, gotten ourselves into is believing that my way is right and your way is wrong, and the only way I can win is that you lose. My philosophy was just the opposite. We need to figure out a path where we can both win, because we both came here for the same reasons. That's to serve the people of this state and to try to make it better. And frankly, if we can find middle ground without just giving in on your principles, mm-hmm. I think the state is far, far better off, and we better serve the people who expect us to deliver them something that is a better life and not just some political victory that I won that only benefited my ego.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about this. There's this famous story about you. You found yourself once at the center of an ethics hearing, the only time ever, because you were accused of shoving a House aide. And then the result of this, like a columnist said, you were, quote, a model of dignity, eloquence, and most relevant, consistent respect for the rules and traditions of the institution. This is after you were the one being accused. Tell us how this happened.
Well, we were in a very difficult fight politically, and the then Speaker of the House chose to take one of my members and actually lock her in his office because he thought he had her vote and he didn't want her to have access to people like me who might try to persuade her otherwise. We found out where she was because her husband called because he couldn't find his bride. And she was, in fact, in the Speaker's conference room. I learned that. I went in and one of the staff came between me and my member and said I had no right to come into the Speaker's office. And I said, well, I'm a member here. She's a member here. I have every right to come in. And he stepped in front of me and said, you will not enter here. And I said, oh, yes, I will. Hmm. And in a moment of anger, and I acknowledge that, I grabbed him, pushed him aside, got my member, and walked out. I recognized immediately that I needed to get my member out, but I also recognized that by putting my hands on another person inside that building, fell beneath the standard we ought to ever expect of people who get elected in a public place like the House. So I immediately went to the floor. This is the same day within an hour, and apologized not only to the gentleman I had offended, but to the House as an institution. Hmm. I had an obligation to conduct myself in a way that more represented my office that I held and less represented my animal instincts about get out of my way. And so after that, my friends in the majority at the time decided, well, an apology was not enough. They wanted to have an ethics hearing on my misconduct. And we went down to do that. And I was fortunate enough, I was blessed that a gentleman named Andy Hurwitz, but one mm-hmm. of the really great, great people I'd ever known in political office, decided he'd represent me. And when we got down to the ethics hearing, they refused to let Andrew speak for me. So Andrew said, Mr. Hamilton, we're leaving. And I looked around and said, Andy, we can't go. He said, we're leaving. So we got up and we walked out of the conference room. And as we did, the entire press corps got them walked out with us because they wanted to have this interview out in the mall about what had happened, why it had happened. And Andrew was smart enough to know that that would be the result. I was not. But because everybody left, the committee members kind of sheepishly adjourned the meeting and the issue died. I am pleased the way it turned out, but absolutely forever will be burdened by the fact that it was necessitated because in that moment of angst, I did something that I think really did, in fact, fall beneath the standard one ought to expect of a public official.
What do you think has happened to that standard since? As you say, like, politics is a very different beast today, and the conduct that we see from lawmakers is very different on all levels.
Well, again, I think we've kind of lost our bearing and lost our way because we've gotten to a place now where we actually reward those who feel that winning at all cost is the only thing that matters. I think the fact that political parties don't have the kind of control, and I know people don't like that word, but the kind of control of the people who come through representing their party. People now are seen basically as individuals. You may register with a party, but you really have, in many cases, as opposed to 90 legislators, members of two different parties, you have basically 90 free agents. And that kind of independence, while seemingly a good thing, really doesn't really allow you to work a political body in a way that produces the best result. The fact of the matter is there needs to be discipline within the chamber. Discipline requires from time to time people understanding that the common good has to always rise above their individual interest and ambitions. Mm. And now with term limits, I served 26 years in the House. I had many opportunities to go elsewhere, mm-hmm. but I never wanted to go anywhere else. I liked being in the legislature. It's what I always wanted, I aspired to do. But people now come in with 8 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate, 8 years anywhere, and they come in with the idea, where do I want to go next? Mm. The fact that people no longer have an obligation to have some time in grade before they are allowed to become whatever it is they aspire to be. Mm-hmm. We now have all the free agents and the ability not to have to be tied to anything other than your own ambition or your ability to raise money or be seen as a political advocate for a cause has hurt the discipline in the place. And I think the result of that is that people come in committed to what it is they want to do and what helps their political career.
Mm-hmm. Looking to move up.
Yep.
It sounds like what you're talking about is a loss of institutional knowledge, but also a loss of respect for the institution.
Well, again, we were taught about comity, courtesy, and reverence for the institution. Polly Rosenbaum, who was a member of the Arizona House, she was one of the senior members. She just was a jewel, Democrat, but a jewel everybody loved. When I came in, she reminded me of two things. I thought I was, you know, good Lord, I got elected, I got seated, I must really be special. Mm. And Polly reminded me that she became a member of the House the year I was born. And so she kind of felt like maybe the world didn't start with me. And I kind of understood that, but I was, as a freshman, talking to a colleague, leaning against one of the desks on the floor, kind of halfway sitting on it, but not really. And Mrs. Rosenbaum walked up and said, Mr. Hamilton, yes, ma'am. Do you sit on the furniture at home like that? Well, no, ma'am. Well, Mr. Hamilton, this is my house, and no one disrespects my house in my presence, sir. I said, yes, ma'am. And it became a training tool that I kept with me the rest of my time in the House. It is the people's house, and we ought to treat it with respect and deference. And if you did not in that day, you had a very long career with almost nothing to be accomplished because no one would give you any respect. That has changed.
Yeah. So you still work in the political realm with your group now helping
yep.
local and state and national organizations yep. sort of navigate the political landscape. Do you see any way back from this?
As for the institution itself, that's going to really require a different attitude in the people who do the electing. I've always believed, and I still believe, that at the end of the day, people will get the kind of political people that they demand. And I think, frankly, we have become complacent about being willing to accept a standard less than the standard that we believe is necessary. I am always reminded, and I sometimes quote, actually, I think I wrote right here, Abraham Lincoln said, America will never be destroyed from the outside. Mm. If we falter and lose our freedoms, it will be because we destroyed ourselves. Mm. And I believe that. I think people have to demand more. I really do believe at the end of the day, politicians will rise to meet whatever standard they're required to meet to attain their political ambition.
Art Hamilton, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.